Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We've all heard the promises. Free mobile phone apps will teach life-saving health and hygiene strategies to the global poor. Passing out laptops to school children in the developing world will level the educational playing field for those who lack proper school facilities or trained teachers. And yet, all those ambitious apps and extra durable computers have yielded uneven results at best, even as Western tech executives send their own kids to schools that make a point of using technology on a limited basis, if at all. My guest spent years working with Microsoft on dozens of expensive and well-meaning projects that somehow failed to deliver on their promises, and he set out to understand why, concluding finally that while smart gadgets have their place, the catalyst for true social change is now what it's always been: smart humans with their hearts in the right place and their boots or sandals on the ground. Kentaro Toyama is associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Information and a fellow of the Dalai Lama Center for Ethics and Transformative Values at MIT. He is also the co-founder and former assistant managing director of Microsoft Research India. His new book is called Geek Heresy: Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. Kentaro, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
It seems as obvious as calling the sky blue to say that technology can deliver us from hardship. But as you point out in the book, the poverty rate in the U.S. has been just about unchanged since 1970. And of course, it grew during the recent recession. And yet we have certainly enjoyed a lot of tech advances in this country at that during that time.
That's right. I mean, we've basically seen a golden age of digital innovation, and yet inequality skyrocketed during the same time and social mobility hasn't gone anywhere. So any idea that the technology by itself causes positive social change is obviously misguided.
You call yourself a recovering technoholic. What made you eager to help set up this major lab for Microsoft in Bangalore?
Well, before I did that, I worked as a computer scientist, as a computer science researcher at Microsoft Research in Redmond. And, you know, I worked on projects that were very interesting from a technical point of view, but they ultimately were only contributing to, you know, more gadgets for wealthy people in countries like the United States. So I thought I wanted to do something that had more impact. And when my manager, who is Indian, asked me if I'd be interested in going with him to set up a new lab, I absolutely said yes.
Of course, you understood that while India is known as a place that, you know, has a lot of technology going for it, there is great poverty. How did you go about trying to understand the conditions that existed there before you went?
I worked a lot with local nonprofit organizations. They are the ones that really have spent, you know, decades often working with poorer communities. They have established rapport. The communities trust them. And, you know, obviously somebody coming from another country with a computer science degree is not going to be able to just plop themselves in a village and start talking to local villagers, especially when there are language barriers. So we always did all of our work through these nonprofit organizations.
To the extent that it's possible to generalize, can you talk about what schools are like for India's poorest children?
Sure. So most of the school children who go to school at all, and of course there are many who don't, they go to government schools. These are the equivalent of public schools in the United States, except that they're much more poorly resourced. On average, the government of India spends something like $200 or $300 U.S. dollars per child per year in that system. And most of that ultimately goes to pay for teachers. The schools are typically in these concrete block buildings. They're very spare. You know, you wouldn't see the kind of richness that you would see even in a poor American school. In some cases, they don't even, you know, they don't have walls at the school. I've seen classes held under, you know, under a large tree. You know, they are missing lots and lots of infrastructure. And then on top of all of that, the teachers are often called away by the government itself to help with government projects like running the census.
Running the census because they are considered, they're government employees. So if there's a lack of people to work on a particular project, they say, let's just grab up some teachers from rural classrooms.
That is exactly right. Hmm.
Another challenge that you found is that many of these students have uneducated parents, of course, who don't have knowledge or the confidence to really engage with their children's schools or with their teachers.
That's right. Many of the parents, of course, are illiterate to begin with. And, you know, they're people who have politically been marginalized. And so, you know, they have no belief that they're going to be able to change how other things work, how a government system works. So unlike in the United States, where you often have active PTA organizations, in India, there are very few such organizations. And even where there are, they tend to be, you know, they tend to be among the elite.
How much experience do teachers in these schools have with technology? So if you bring in a full suite of, you know, brand new Microsoft products, who knows how to run it?
Increasingly, teachers there do have a little bit more interaction with technology. They will often have, you know, had some access during their training. But on the whole, very little. You know, most of the teachers will not have routine internet access at home. You know, their understanding of the technology is very limited. In fact, you know, many of them feel kind of overwhelmed when technology is introduced in their classrooms because the students are more than happy to engage, but the teachers don't necessarily know how to operate the tools.
One thing that might take people by surprise, although it shouldn't, is that kids in the developing world are just like kids in this part of the world. They will do homework on computers occasionally, but when there's a game or a video or something more fun, that's what they're drawn to.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, in America, if you look over the shoulder of any child with a smartphone, what you see isn't that they're, you know, doing math problem sets or writing
right.
assignments. They're playing Angry Birds. Mm-hmm. And that is true everywhere in the world. You know, one thing that's interesting about kids is that because they haven't had time to kind of absorb the culture and socialization of their environments, they're often very similar everywhere. And on the one hand, they do have a tremendous curiosity and a desire to learn, but they also have an equally strong, if not stronger, tendency to seek out entertainment and diversion. And so when you give them a powerful tool like you know, a smartphone or a computer that allows them to do either learning or entertainment, they tend to choose entertainment.
So one of the first problems that you set out to solve, or a major problem, was the fact that even schools that were wired for technology often didn't have enough terminals to allow every student to interface with technology. Can you talk about how you recognized the problem and what you and your colleagues did to fix that?
Absolutely. Early on, we would go into these schools to understand better what their conditions were. We were actually surprised that, you know, quite a few government schools actually had computer labs. But there would only be a handful of computers in these rooms, maybe four or five. And of course, if you have a class with 30 or 40 children coming in, what that means is you have gangs of children surrounding each machine. And often a dominant child would just pick up the keyboard and mouse, leaving everybody else to kind of watch. So we thought this was a perfect, you know, place for technological innovation. And basically what we did was to allow each computer to have multiple mice, and each mouse would have a differently colored cursor on the screen. And you could then write educational software that allowed kids to either compete or collaborate with each other to learn things. When we did studies, you know, in our pilot schools, we found that this allowed each student, even five to a computer, to learn just as much as one student with a computer all to themselves.
So that was certainly an interesting result, got everybody very excited. But then to your great disappointment, the early successes of that multi-point project, which is what it was called, fell flat on a lot of other campuses.
That's right. So, you know, we thought that this was a great technology. It seems to be working. It potentially allows many more children to interact with computers at the same cost. And so we started trying to roll it out to other schools. And of course, you know, in our pilots, we worked with schools that were conducive to this. You know, they had strong teachers, willing headmasters, you know, reasonable amount of resources. But we thought that the schools who needed this kind of intervention the most were the ones that were struggling otherwise. And so we went to schools that, you know, didn't have the well-trained teachers, didn't have principals who were really focused on improving education. And what we found was right off the bat, we just could not even get to the point where the technology would run in a classroom. You know, I remember many situations where we would struggle for, you know, at least 25 minutes just to set up the technology. The teachers were themselves afraid to touch the technology. In many cases, they, you know, struggled even to teach students what they were going through in their own curriculum. And so, you know, when more technology was introduced, when something more complex was introduced, they kind of were scared off by it. And we found this in school after school, which is to say that Ultimately, if there isn't firm, strong pedagogical capacity in the school to begin with, it didn't make a difference how good the technology was. It wouldn't take.
It made me think about those projects that we've heard about in parts of the developing world where NGOs come in and build pretty modern hospital facilities and say, here you go, poor rural community, and then back away without having made arrangements for, like, trained doctors and nurses to come and staff the place.
That's right. You know, I've come to say that all of technology follows what I call a law of amplification. And that's the idea that the technology itself doesn't necessarily do anything good or bad, but it amplifies whatever human force is already in place. So in the example you gave with, you know, technology and clinics for rural areas, you know, if you don't have a strong healthcare system in place, manned by good doctors and nurses and community healthcare workers, then just setting up the clinic or just providing medical equipment doesn't do the trick.
So how does technology magnify inequality?
Well, if you believe in amplification, then what it tells you is that exactly the people who already have advantages, whether it's wealth or education or social ties or political influence, are also the ones who can better make use of the technology. And what that means is that in an absolute sense, if you apply technology everywhere, it turns out that the people with the advantages to begin with end up with even more advantages. It's another case of the rich getting richer. One place where we see this, for example, even in the United States, is with massive open online courses, which when they were first introduced were seen as an easy, cheap, free way to get more people college education. But now that we've had several years to look at the data, what we find is that the people who complete those courses are predominantly college-educated professionals, not jobless high school dropouts.
How do people in these poor areas feel about people coming in from the outside and bringing technological solutions? Do they get excited and on board at first, or do they tend to approach a lot of these efforts with some skepticism?
Their response varies. You know, places where there have been all kinds of programs running and, you know, they see outsiders come and go, they tend to be a little bit cynical. You know, they don't feel that people are really working for them and it's just a matter of dropping various technologies or policies in place and then leaving soon after. But of course, you know, people that are, you know, that have seen technology in the hands of others, you know, whether it's in the city or on television or in movies, they actually do get excited about the technology. But it's often without a firm understanding of what exactly the technology might do for them.
Do we have a problem here with the direction of philanthropy? Because I can imagine that it is much sexier to say, I'm going to give money and put five, you know, PCs into a classroom than to say, I'm going to make sure that this school has working toilets for the next 10 years.
No, I think that's true. Although, frankly, even the working toilets are sexy in some quarters. you know, I think what it is that as long as you're giving tangible objects, you have a fantastic photo op. There's a moment in which you're handing off, you know, the artifact, and you see either smiling kids or smiling parents, and it looks like you're making some kind of impact. You're having some kind of positive impact. But the reality is that, you know, oftentimes after the photograph is taken, you know, within months, if not days, the technology stops being used or, you know, malfunctions. And if the local community doesn't have the capacity to repair it or to maintain it, which often people don't work to create, then the technology by itself is useless.
More than once, you walked onto a campus that had donated computers and found them locked away somewhere.
Oh, absolutely. I remember in particular one case where, you know, the principal proudly showed us his computers, and they were locked away in this cabinet. It was an enclosed cabinet, yet, you know, everything in there was piled up with, you know, dust from, I guess, years of non-use. You know, in many schools we found in India, they're given computers by their local governments, but then because they're state assets, they have to keep track of them, even if they're not being used on a day-to-day basis.
My guest is Kentaro Toyama. He is associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Information and a fellow of the Dalai Lama Center for Ethics and Transformative Values at MIT. His new book is called Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. If you've got a question or a story to share, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find me online at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Kentaro Toyama about his new book, Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. He's a fellow at the Dalai Lama Center for Ethics and Transformative Values at MIT. As a side note, the Dalai Lama himself will be speaking tomorrow at 1:30 at SMU's Moody Coliseum. That event is sold out, but we will have a report tomorrow afternoon during All Things Considered. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Kentaro, one thing about this whole story that I find really ironic is the fact that, India is the sort of place where there's a lot happening in high tech. There's a lot of production taking place, a lot of innovation. Can you talk about that?
You're right, absolutely. So, one reason why I went there in the first place was because we thought, here's a country with an incredible information technology industry. And yet at the same time, the country is still home to, something like 800 million people who would be considered destitute by any American standard. And so, one of the questions that we got all the time there was, how can we take the success of the technology sector and spread it to the rest of the country? And I think that's, in fact, one of the impetuses of trying to use technology for poverty alleviation.
And one of the ideas you came away with was that we really need to train young people, our students, to be producers of technology as opposed to simply consumers of technology.
That's right. There's a tendency, I think, among many people, even very well-educated, intelligent ones, that simply spending time with more technology is somehow valuable. I make this analogy with driving a car. You can drive a car and be a great driver, but that doesn't mean that you're going to get a job as an engineer at Ford, for example. Similarly, you can be a great user of Facebook, but that's not going to get you a job at Facebook, the company.
Right.
And that's because software engineering is a very, complex skill that requires a solid education as opposed to, being able to use Facebook. Increasingly, exactly because of the technological developments, anybody can use technology, but the use of technology is very different from being able to, have a productive career in it.
And you noted that a lot of your colleagues back in the U.S. who had kids of school age were deliberately seeking out school facilities that did not over-focus on technology.
That's right. There are Waldorf schools in Silicon Valley which basically ban all electronics until the eighth grade and encourage the parents at home to do similarly. And the children who go to these schools are children of parents who work at companies like eBay and Google and so on. The parents obviously are, they're incredible technology evangelists at work. They want to spread technology. They believe that it's good for other people. And yet, for their own children, they tend to show some restraint. There was a quote about Steve Jobs in the New York Times where he basically said that he didn't give iPads to his children because he limited the use of technology at home.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Doug in Rockwall. Hi, Doug.
Yes. Hi, Chris. Hello, Professor. I had a question for you. The use of technology for historically economically disadvantaged students. My old high school is now majority African Americans, neither here nor there, but they are economically disadvantaged largely. They got a donation of very expensive and fast computers. My question for you is this: Is it a wise investment to have technology when it's available from the community or from a philanthropist to create what I would call a brand identity? In other words, these students use GPS technology to map crime statistics, and they actually ended up helping a number of police departments. They got a lot of notoriety for that, and on account of that notoriety, some of these kids went to outstanding schools across the country. And I just wanted your thoughts on, if you have $10,000 to give, is it a good idea to have a brand connection for a school to which you're going to give that money? I'll take my answer off here.
Thanks for your call.
That's a great question. And let me distinguish two different things. So As I said, you know, technology amplifies underlying human forces. In an educational context, that means that the technology amplifies the pedagogical capacity that a school or a household has. So if the school is doing very well, you know, if his children are learning to read at the right age, if they're able to do, you know, basic mathematics, if they're learning their science and history, there's a good chance that it is operating in a way that is functional, and therefore it could probably incorporate technology in a way that would actually supplement the education. That's a case of the the amplification power of technology actually doing a positive thing. But if you consider a school which, for whatever reason, might be failing, you know, its students, maybe the students are not graduating, maybe they are graduating but not actually able to achieve the educational objectives for their grade level, then I would suggest that those schools are struggling for other reasons, whether it's pedagogical, economic, social, cultural, or whatever. And in those situations, no amount of technology can turn things around. So in your case, it sounds like you were saying that the school is making positive use of the technology. And in that case, I think that's terrific. You know, that's exactly the right way to use technology. But in many other schools in the country, you know, the school is struggling just to meet its basic objectives. And in those cases, I think if you have an extra $10,000, you should definitely apply it for more and better adult guidance, not on technology.
Of course, it's not only the problems of children that are seen as potential targets for technology. I want to talk about mobile apps. As a greater percentage of even very poor people start to carry mobile devices, it would seem like apps could be a great tool for sharing important information. Can you talk about why sometimes these efforts have backfired?
Absolutely. You know, so I live in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I'm an hour away from Detroit. And if you go to Detroit, you know, this is a city that has seen many better days. You'll see all kinds of people on the street, all carrying, you know, fancy mobile phones, smartphones, and so on. And of course, they have access to whatever is out there in the form of mobile apps or the internet. But it's not necessarily helping them get a better job. It's not helping them get a better education and so on. And this is because you need so much more than the app, than the information to really benefit from. When I was writing my book, I worked a lot in public libraries. And it turns out that in this country, public libraries are a place where a lot of the homeless population go during the day because it's, you know, a comfortable environment and they have access to the internet. I would see the same clients come back month after month, year after year, and they apparently were not any better off, even though they had this great access to the internet.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Daniel on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was curious to hear, like, is the conversation within the tech industry and within tech politics changing to recognize this tech amplification that you're talking about, wherein a lot of times the kind of stereotype is that you have the Silicon Valley moguls talking about how Twitter or Facebook or new social media is going to revolutionize and change these social dynamics without necessarily recognizing the underlying institutional capacity. Is that shifting within the industry, or is that still kind of far out there as far as tech dynamics go?
I have to say that I'm sure that a big shift is in place yet. You know, of course, my intention is to see if I can even nudge things along in a more productive direction. On the whole, I would say that, you know, there's a great tendency among Silicon Valley entrepreneurs to believe that, you know, because they have succeeded in one area of life, that they can therefore, you know, that they know how to solve many other kinds of problems. But that, at least to me, doesn't make any more sense than, you know, let's say a concert violinist imagining that they have the solution to global poverty. One of the things that I think we have to understand as a society is that business success in no way necessarily means that there's a delivery of real social value. And we have to understand that, you know, people who've succeeded in one arena don't necessarily have the understanding to really help us with other areas of life.
How can we put in the proper context the potential of technology to promote democracy, to undermine corruption in government, that sort of thing?
Well, in my book, I talk about the supposed Facebook revolution in the Arab Spring. People used to say that, you know, the Egyptian revolution was begun by Facebook. I think that if we're going to call those revolutions a Facebook revolution, we have to call the American revolution a lantern revolution because of Paul Revere and one if by land, two if by sea. You know, the reality is that revolutionaries will use whatever communication tools at their disposal. And if, you know, depending on the time and the generation, of course, that means different tools. I imagine in the future we'll have revolutions when people use, you know, direct brain-to-brain transmitters. if you look in other countries in the Middle East, such as Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, they actually were groups who were trying to start protests. I guess they thought that, you know, Facebook revolutions could be started in their countries as well. And they worked a lot on social media and advertised. But it turns out that in those countries, the monarchy has really stunted any kind of civil society. So there was no real organizational force to amplify. And the technology fell flat. And, you know, at least in the West, we didn't even hear about these attempts, largely because they didn't go anywhere. Meanwhile, in China, you have a population that has, you know, many mobile phones. There are over 1 billion mobile phone accounts in the country, probably close to 750 million people with internet access. And yet we don't see, you know, routine calls for a revolution there. And that's probably because, at least at this point, as long as the economy is growing, citizens there are happy with the way things are.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak now with Sharon in Arlington. Hey, Sharon.
Hey, good afternoon. I have a question. I'm a teacher, and I maybe am overly fond of using computers in the classroom. I'm just kind of reevaluating that. This particular program is helping a lot. But I would like for the gentleman to comment, if you would, on the difference between using technology as a tool, as opposed to, it seems now, that you know, an awful lot of materials that once were published as textbooks and now have been just wholesale dumped into an electronic format. And so students are really using the same materials, they're just looking at them differently. They're able to jump around in a textbook that's hyperlinked, but I question that that you've not really gotten anywhere.
What do you think, Kintara?
That's a terrific question, and I appreciate your willingness to consider the tools that you're using. You know, first of all, I should say that if you are doing something positive already, and in your case, you're teaching children, and I assume that you're good at it, then of course you should use technology to the extent that it enhances what you're doing. And you know, one of the marks of a good teacher is that they know exactly when a technology is really contributing to good education and when it's distracting. And I think one of the challenges that we see these days is that it's believed that just moving something from paper to an electronic medium in and of itself somehow helps students. But oftentimes, all that's happened is that there's just some fancy graphics or, as you were mentioning, some hyperlinks possibly to animations and so on that are added. And one of the challenges with that, I think, is that I think we're kind of providing children with what I think of as cognitive candy. And, you know, if the whole point of an education is a nutritional intellectual meal, then providing them these blingy rewards isn't necessarily the right thing any more than we would give children sweets before dinner.
A few weeks ago, we had Greg Topper on the show, who is a writer, I believe, for USA Today, and he's got this new book out that is very much in support of the idea of learning through computer games. You have a sentence in here, a couple of sentences that I love. Children have a flair for sniffing out games and playing them behind the backs of supervising adults. They also have a sixth sense for educational content, and they avoid it like they avoid broccoli. So are you saying that just because you make math or social studies or literature into a computer game doesn't mean kids will play it with the same zeal that they approach, I can't even name a game, Doom
Candy
or something?
Crush.
Candy Crush. There you go. All right. Thank you.
No, I think that is absolutely true. You know, at least in my experience, what I find is that even the most compelling educational applications, even when they're in video game format, are less interesting to children than, you know, games that are purely games and have no educational content. My guess is that, you know, all of your listening teachers out there have experienced something like this. But I think the challenge is even deeper than that. Let's suppose, for example, that, you know, we could accomplish education through what's called gamification, which is the idea that you turn every learning opportunity into a game, and often that means into a video game. Well, you know, assume children go through this kind of education from kindergarten through 12th grade. What will you have achieved at the end of that? It's, you know, it's true that maybe the children will have learned whatever content in terms of science and history, and maybe a little bit of math and so on that they're supposed to learn. But at the end of it, we will have failed at the larger mission of teaching kids how to learn on their own. Effectively, we'll have raised a generation of children who can only learn things if it's in the context of a game. And to me, that's a far greater disservice to, you know, our children and to our future society than it would be if we're not necessarily teaching, you know, the content of education in a short-term way.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next up, we have Jeshua on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jeshua.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question for the professor regarding a phenomenon in Japan that I had heard about called hikikomori, which is people, typically young people, I believe, that cocoon themselves in technology and have very little to no social life and isolate themselves. And I just was wondering what the professor's comments or feelings towards this are. Thank you.
Absolutely. You know, that is, in fact, a phenomenon in Japan. And it's not just that they isolate themselves digitally, but they often will retreat into their own, you know, private rooms and not come out often for days at a time. It's definitely a strange phenomenon. But again, there, too, the technology is effectively amplifying people's capacity to do this. I think increasingly we are seeing the virtual equivalent of that even in America, where, you know, people are so busy communicating with each other on their smartphones that they don't pay attention to their surroundings. They don't know how to interact with people live. This past semester, I taught a group of undergraduate students, all of whom, of course, use technology on a regular basis. And even they were worried that, you know, their own culture and society were headed in a direction in which people were not willing to interact and actually avoided certain kinds of direct confrontations or certain kinds of intimate, you know, interactions simply because they were so used to having this thin form of interaction digitally.
Is it easy for you to get your colleagues excited about maybe volunteering time, not to set up computers in a school, but to sit down with kids and read to them or have interactions that will affect their education but don't necessarily directly involve a piece of hardware?
It depends a lot on their true motivations for what they're trying to accomplish. You know, I have colleagues who are excited primarily that, you know, they want to spread more technology and possibly be associated with the, you know, greater penetration of technology. And they're not, I don't think, ultimately interested in helping people one-to-one. They see it as a waste of time to, you know, to deal with people on an individual basis. On the other hand, I also have, you know, good friends and colleagues who, you know, recognize that the true thing that we need are people who have, you know, better capacity, stronger ability to meet their own objectives. In some sense, it's, you know, trying to help them become better versions of themselves. And they definitely do volunteer in their spare time or, you know, donate to causes that are teaching children, mentoring adults, you know, somehow helping people with their own aspirations.
Kentaro Toyama is my guest. He's associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Information and co-founder and former assistant managing director of Microsoft Research India. His new book is called Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. You can be in on this conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to Kentaro Toyama, a fellow of the Dalai Lama Center for Ethics and Transformative Values at MIT, about his new book, Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. Kentaro, how far up does anybody need to be on Maslow's hierarchy of need before we can reasonably expect high-tech devices and apps and software to be truly useful to us and cause us to gain prosperity?
Conceivably, it could be useful to them at any level. It really depends on whether they have the capacity to achieve their aspirations. I actually think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs more as a hierarchy of aspirations, where at each stage, people have these, you know, longer-term desires about what they really want to achieve for themselves. And to the extent that they have the capacity to achieve those aspirations, I think technology can help.
Back to the phones now. This time, we'll speak with Gail in Dallas. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I'm a 26-year veteran teacher, and I'm finding that it is becoming more and more difficult to keep the kids' attention because of their short attention span, which I assume is attributed to the amount of time they spend on technology outside the classroom. And what I find is that administrators and curriculum specialists keep putting the pressure on the teachers to find ways to engage the students. And a lot of times, you know, they're asking us to incorporate technology, which I'm not against, but like I can find, well, I teach Spanish as a second language, and I can do the grammar lesson on the whiteboard, I feel, more effectively, but many times I'll do a PowerPoint because I have to face the class because I teach middle school, and I can, if I turn my back for a couple of seconds, they're shooting rubber bands, they're throwing paper airplanes, and so I sometimes have to use technology more as a discipline management tool than as a really tool to teach them the concept.
What do you think about that, Kintara?
I mean, I sympathize completely. You know, as I mentioned, I think of digital technology in the schools often being more like cognitive candy. And it's true that in the short term, you can engage kids with candy. But what that means, if you keep doing relying on it, is in the long term, you know, you have kids who will want to eat nothing but sweets. I think we are in a time when we're collectively under this belief that more technology in the classroom somehow helps children, although it turns out that in the medium to long term, it does exactly the opposite thing. And I think we have to fight back against that, both as as parents, as teachers, even as students. Increasingly, you know, I find that even in my own classes, my students are the ones who are happy that I basically forbid laptops in the classroom except when we have assignments that require it.
You've been really influenced by the work of the philosopher Peter Singer. Can you talk a little bit about how his writing and scholarship has influenced the way you look at the proper role of technology in philanthropy?
Well, I think he does a terrific job of explaining why it's important for all of us to focus our efforts on, you know, making a societal contribution. He makes a strong case. One thing that I think he leaves out is that it's not enough for us to understand these things intellectually. It requires, you know, a lot of maturation as individuals and as a society to do the things that we believe are right. So, for example, even in my own case, you know, I firmly believe that I should, you know, if I could, give away as much of my income as possible for causes that I believe in. But, you know, even if I do that at 10 or 20% of my income, you know, I have a very difficult time going above that because I enjoy the comforts of my own life. But if I were a more mature person, if I were, you know, somehow more enlightened in a sense, I think I would be able to do that better. And I think that's true of society as a whole as well.
I came away from your book thinking that placing our faith in technology to cure social problems is a little bit like trying to finance retirement by buying lottery tickets, right? Instead of saving and investing, it's theoretically possible to win big, but it seems like the slow and steady, more laborious approach is more likely to pay off.
That's right. I mean, I think just like, you know, technology ends up being a distraction for children, it's also becoming a distraction for us as a society, and that we keep hoping that the answers to our deep social challenges will come out, you know, through these quick fixes. But the reality is that, you know, we have to attend to the underlying social, political, cultural, economic issues exactly because technology amplifies those things. In a funny way, you know, exactly because we live in a world in which there's abundant technology, it's all the more important that we get the human side correct.
We have a question here from Esteban who wants to know, how does profit motive for tech developers fit into this equation? Are they even motivated to make better educational materials when they can probably make more money with, say, an iPhone game?
That's a great question, and I think that in many cases, what Esteban is alluding to is probably correct. There are plenty of people in Silicon Valley whose primary motive is profit and to, you know, start the next big thing, mostly for the purposes of being able to say that, you know, they have a huge company. It's not clear to me at all that they have the interests of, you know, real children in heart. And in fact, you know, if you really do have those interests at heart, you know, the first thing you would do is actually go and try the things that that are supposedly good for children. And I think you'll find very quickly that, you know, with electronic gadgets, the value to children is much less than people tend to believe.
Cayenne in downtown Dallas wants to know, what are some examples of apps or programs where developers have stepped away from trends in technology in favor of addressing real social problems? Are there places where this does work?
In my book, I talk about a project that came out of my lab called Digital Green. This is a particular use of digital video to help farmers in India and other developing world countries learn better agricultural practices. The idea is very simple. It's, you know, we create these 10-minute how-to videos featuring local farmers and use those videos as teaching aids in group sessions where farmers come together and discuss the content of the video. We found that, you know, if you do this well, that it actually helps farmers adopt better practices 7 times more than the more traditional form of agriculture extension, which involves kind of a person-to-person engagement by a trained officer. But even with this project, we're very, very conscious that the technology is amplifying an underlying institution. So Digital Green is now a nonprofit, and its mission is to find organizations that already have farmer welfare at heart and then help them do their job even better by using technology. The converse, you know, idea, which, you know, one might believe in, is that somehow the videos are doing the magic by themselves, in which case you would try to spread videos everywhere, you know, everywhere as much as possible. Maybe you'd imagine that all the videos should be uploaded on YouTube and every farmer should be given an iPad so that they could watch these. But in our experience, that doesn't work. And in fact, you know, there's proof already that, you know, the same farmers often have access to television shows about agricultural content, but they don't, in fact, learn that much from them, exactly because they don't have the trust with the organizations that we work with.
So what makes Digital Green work is the combination of human interaction and informative content.
That's right. It's that underlying human foundation that's absolutely critical for technology to do the right thing.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we have Josh on the line in Granbury. Hi, Josh.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a quick question for your guest about educational games again. He mentioned that kids tend to sniff out educational content and games, and that sort of turns them off, whereas, you know, regular games where it doesn't have, like, a direct educational application, they seem to get into those kind of games. And I wondered if... So... If you sort of turn the process in reverse and as a teacher tried to take a game that they're interested in already, like a Minecraft or a Candy Crush or Call of Duty or whatever, and then tried to draw educational applications out of that game, so like asking questions like what's the best strategy to win the game, what, you know, like statistical questions on, like, if you're looking at, you know, Halo, like, what's the best gun over time, or, you know, those sorts of things. Is that something where that would be effective and kids would like that, or do you think they'll still be turned off by that approach, even though it's a game that they like?
Well, I think that, you know, if you have a good teacher, they will turn anything into a positive educational opportunity. And, of course, that includes video games as well. I'm sure there are plenty of great teachers out there, you know, who can take the, you know, what seems to be the most, you know, uninstructive video game and somehow draw a lesson from it. But all of that is to say that it's not the technology delivering that learning experience. It's really the teacher. You know, my guess is you could do exactly the same thing with teachers who go out into parks and just observe the flora and fauna that's in a park. Or, you know, teachers who might go into the inner city and say, well, you know, here's a lot that's open. You know, what can we learn from the fact that there's a vacancy here, and so on and so forth. So again, if you have a great teacher, technology is great, of course, but you also, in some weird way, don't need the technology because the teacher will take care of the learning needs otherwise.
So what does this suggest to you for people who would like to make a positive difference in the world, maybe are not in a position to physically travel to the developing world and provide, you know, educational instruction or, you know, work with farmers or work with healthcare workers? How can we think about where to put our money and how exactly to invest it in the developing world?
Well, personally, I believe that efforts to increase human capacity, you know, whether it's through education or some kind of mentorship or, you know, helping others learn skills that they want to learn, is really the best way to support, you know, overall advancement of society. And I think that that can be done through organizations that do those things. It is, in fact, a little bit difficult to, you know, judge organizations based on, you know, what they do if you can't travel to the site. But, you know, increasingly, thanks to technology, there are more and more sites that kind of review what organizations do. You know, there are comments about different organizations. So I think even sitting in your living room, you can often make a meaningful contribution to either a nonprofit or even in some cases a private firms that are actually seeking the betterment of society elsewhere.
Let's speak next with Gabrielle in Keller. Hi, Gabrielle.
Hi, good afternoon. I was wondering, I entered the program late, about alternative or offline programs like chess. If the author had discussed, you know, because chess makes you, helps you think forward. And it's low-tech, but it's also available in high-tech for students as a learning experience.
Yeah, for me, ultimately, the most important thing is adult guidance. You know, I think, you know, if you once you instill in a child the desire to play chess and they really want to get good at it, you can imagine that they'll spend hours at a computer just playing a chess game. And of course, they're learning something there. I'm not convinced that you want children to be doing that, you know, 8 hours a day for all 12 years of their education. But it does seem to me that there are instances where, of course, technological tools make sense. But that's often, again, because it's done under, you know, situations with very good adult guidance, either that of the parents or of teachers at school. And again, if you have that adult guidance, there is no reason why you shouldn't use technology to enhance that, to amplify that.
When you first arrived at these conclusions that technology will not be the miracle fix we might have all hoped for, did it make you sad given the early course of your career and your assumption that somebody could invent the perfect thing to really fix problems that are really troubling in the world?
You know, I was never really an extreme techno-utopian in the sense that I didn't think that, you know, some one technology was going to solve all the problems of the world. But I did think that, on the whole, that well-designed technologies would make the world a better place simply by disseminating them. And, you know, I have to say it took me a long time to kind of come to grips with the idea that that wasn't the case. I'm trained as a scientist, and so what I wanted to understand ultimately was why our projects didn't work at larger scale. And it wasn't just one project, but project after project after project, you know, dozens of them. And when you see a pattern like that, when you're confronted with that, you have no choice but to really try to understand what the underlying phenomenon is. And what I discovered was that, again, technology is a tool that amplifies what it's what people want to do with it. It's a very simple idea, but it has far-reaching consequences.
What kind of pep talk would you offer to a group of computer engineers who were going to go take over the kind of work that you'd been doing with Microsoft in India?
That's a great question. You know, the first thing I would say is for them to kind of understand in their own life what allowed them to be successful in theirs. And very quickly, you know, people come to the realization that it wasn't so much that they happened to own a laptop for, you know, a good chunk of their life, but that there was at some point an inspiring teacher, or maybe it was that their parents gave them a laptop exactly at the right time when they were ready to, you know, do productive things with it, do interesting things with it. Whatever it was, you know, almost always a little introspection suggests that, you know, people who are software engineers have had something in their life that sparked this desire to learn and to create. And, you know, to me, that's the thing that we want to replicate in the world, not the tools of our trade, but the spark to create, to engineer, and to learn. And to the extent possible, I think, you know, those of us who already have those skills are exactly the right people to try to, you know, to teach them to other children, whether it's within our own countries or elsewhere. There is a shortage of, you know, adults who are willing to spend time on a one-to-one basis with children. There is no reason why all of us who really care about that shouldn't be able to find opportunities to help children.
Kentaro Toyama is associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Information and a fellow of the Dalai Lama Center for Ethics and Transformative Values at MIT. He is also the co-founder and former assistant managing director of Microsoft Research India. His new book is called Geek Heresy: Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. Kentaro, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. If you'd like to email the show, the address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.